ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, welcome to PM. I'm Samantha Donovan, coming to you from the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation in Melbourne. Tonight, the unemployment rate rises slightly, boosting hopes of an interest rate cut next month. Also, the latest on Israel's bombing of targets in Syria. And does the ABC's Triple J Hottest 100 poll do justice to Australian music?
If we think Australian music is the best in the world, why shouldn't it go up against the best tunes from all around the world every year? For me, seeing brand new artists off unearthed land on the list is one of those things that makes the Hottest 100 so special.
First this evening to the economy, and Australia's unemployment rate has unexpectedly risen to 4.3%, its highest level since November 2021. Tens of thousands of full-time jobs were lost in June. As our business correspondent David Taylor reports, the increase makes an interest rate cut in August more likely.
More Australian workers are being shown the door, but economists say, for now, it's not clear what's going on.
Yes, the labour market is still strong. This was a weaker month, but with monthly data, you are going to get these small changes, and it isn't necessarily the beginning of a trend. We'd need a couple more months' data to become convinced that this was anything more than a little bit of loosening in the labour market, but also a little bit of sample volatility.
ANZ senior economist Adelaide Timbrell is referring to what could be a statistical blip in today's figures.
We have to remember, like most economic data, the labour force data is not perfect. And what happened was the people who were being surveyed this month versus last month were more likely to be unemployed before that survey began. So although the data does seem to show some loosening in the labour market, we need to temper that with the idea that part of this increase in the unemployment rate may be because of who was asked rather than an economy that has changed.
The official data also shows trend unemployment rising to 4.2%. And there are also some signs bosses are preferencing short-term hires over permanent ones. Figures from the Bureau of Statistics show full-time jobs decreased by 38,000, while part-time employment increased by 40,000. AMP's chief economist, Shane Oliver, says there's evidence the jobs market's deteriorating.
So that is a clear sign, I think, the labour market is weakening. And it's not just due to statistical anomalies. We actually saw very weak employment numbers. I think it was up 2,000, as you just told us. So that was pretty soft. Consensus was for a 20,000 rise in jobs. And to top it off, full-time employment actually fell, as did hours worked. So to me, it's a sign the labour market is starting to soften. We had seen that in job vacancies data. But so far, the labour markets remain fairly strong. But it looks like we are starting to see that weakness starting to come through.
Minister for Employment and Workplace Relations, Amanda Rishworth, blames global economic uncertainty for the labour market malaise.
Well, of course, what we have been focused on is making sure that we are navigating global uncertainty. There is significant global uncertainty across the world. And of course, that has an impact here in Australia.
The slightly higher unemployment rate is already raising hopes of an interest rate cut next month. The Reserve Bank held rates steady earlier this month, preferring, it said, to wait for more data on the economy to confirm that inflation is back under control. Amanda Rishworth was asked today, given the rise in the jobless rate, if she thought the RBA had made a mistake in not cutting interest rates at the last meeting.
Well, of course, the Reserve Bank is independent and they've outlined their reasons for keeping rates on hold. It was obviously a great disappointment to many Australians, that decision. But of course, the Reserve Bank will meet again and will consider not only the inflation data, but also this employment data as well.
Adelaide Timbrell says she expects the Reserve Bank will cut interest rates again in August and again in November. And Shane Oliver agrees.
But so far, in terms of those looking for a rate cut, you get a tick in terms of the jobs numbers because they are on the soft side. A breakout to a new high in unemployment, softer jobs growth for a couple of months in a row. So that's that I think is a pointer to a cut coming. I think today's results will just add to expectations by money market traders and economists that we will get a cut in August, or in other words, reinforce those expectations.
AMP Chief Economist Shane Oliver ending that report from our business correspondent David Taylor. Now to the Middle East, where Israel's military has been bombing Syria's defence ministry in Damascus and government forces. Israel's intervention came after days of violence in Syria involving those government forces, local Bedouin clans and militia from the religious minority Druze community. Matthew Doran is the ABC's Middle East correspondent. Matthew, what's the situation in Syria at the moment?
Sam, good evening. We know that there has been a ceasefire agreed to by the local groups who have been involved in these deadly clashes over the last couple of days. The local Bedouin clans in southern Syria, the Druze militia there, and the Syrian government forces who were deployed down to the south of the country in and around the city of Suwaida to try to quell some of that violence, but who also were involved in that situation. So that's the latest there. There had been some confusion overnight as to whether or not that ceasefire would be holding, whether or not all of those parties had agreed to it. But we have seen scenes coming out of southern Syria of those Syrian government forces withdrawing from Suwaida and heading back north towards Damascus, around 100 kilometres away. There are differing reports as to exactly how many people have been killed in these clashes. Some of the reports suggest it's up to 300 people in this sectarian violence, but some of those details remain unclear. What is really, I think, the concern here is the intervention by Israel in this conflict, and that it not only targeting southern Syria around the city of Suwaida, but also, as we saw yesterday local time, a dramatic escalation, launching missiles, dropping missiles on the Syrian military headquarters in central Damascus, also attacking the Syrian presidential palace, clearly showing that Israel clearly is trying to send a message here to the regime of the new Syrian leader, Ahmed al-Sharr, the former Islamist militant-turned-president there, that it is willing to flex its military might in this space.
Yes, Matthew, can you tell us more about why Israel has got itself involved in this conflict in Syria? What, it's got some connection with the Druze community?
That's right. So Israel says that it is trying to protect the Druze community, which is a religious minority that primarily lives in southern Syria. Now, there is also a Druze community that lives in Israeli territory, not only in Israel itself, but in the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights, which is the area that Israel seized from Syria during the 1967 war and annexed back in 1981. That's actually where we're speaking to you from today, the town of Majdal Shams, which is a largely Druze community where there is a border fence running between the Golan Heights and that Syrian buffer zone. That fence was actually breached yesterday by the Israeli, by members of the Druze community here in Majdal Shams, and those who'd come from further afield. They brought they came to the site, they stormed the fence, many of them broke through. Indeed, some even drove cars through the area into Syria for the first time that they had been able to do that in many, many years, and saw some of their family members who were on the other side of the fence. We know some Syrians also came over this side of the fence. We spoke to one man who hadn't seen his brother for some 40-odd years, and they met yesterday for the first time in a long time. Israel is saying that it wants to protect that community, that it is an important part of the Israeli community, but certainly there are concerns that this is actually broader than that, that this is just an opportunistic attack by Israel to try to unsettle a country that has gone through decades of civil war and dictatorship, that is now trying to get back on path under a new regime, and it's trying to exploit the concerns that are there about Ahmed al-Sharr and his Islamist militant background, what influence that could have on uniting the country there.
Matthew, how are the Israeli people reacting to its defence forces getting involved in yet another conflict after the attack on Iran and the ongoing conflict in Gaza?
Well, I think the most important and most interesting part there are the Israeli Druze community. We know that the Druze, it's a bit of a generalisation, but the Druze are generally loyal to the state of Israel, particularly those who are outside of the Golan Heights. And we heard from a number of people who had stormed the fence yesterday that they did so because they wanted to convince Israel to go even further. They thought that by running into this Syrian buffer zone that exists between the Golan Heights and the rest of Syria, that would convince Israel that there was even more people out there that needed to be protected.
And how has the Trump administration responded to the situation in Syria?
We heard from Marco Rubio, the US Secretary of State, yesterday. He described it as a very complex situation in Syria that had led to some misunderstandings between the Syrian population and the Israeli population there, sort of saying that these long-held, complex rivalries among the Bedouins and the Druze had drawn the bigger players here into the fighting there. Marco Rubio was quite concerned about the situation, but he was also convinced there could be some sort of relative peace achieved in a short while. And certainly it seems from the reports, so we're seeing this morning local time that there hasn't been a whole lot more in terms of Israeli strikes in Syria, but we will monitor that in the coming hours to see whether or not the situation has eased or if Israel is going to continue striking Syrian government forces.
Matthew Doran is the ABC's Middle East correspondent. This is PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. You can hear all our programs live or later on the ABC Listen app. Ahead, a global poll finds Australia is doing pretty well when it comes to managing chronic diseases. Pressure is mounting on the New South Wales Parliament to take action against former federal Labor leader, now independent state MP, Mark Latham. It follows media reports of inappropriate behaviour towards female MPs and an allegation he recorded a sex tape in his parliamentary office. Mr. Latham has denied any wrongdoing. Our reporter Gavin Coote is following the story. Gavin, what are these latest allegations being levelled against Mark Latham?
Well, Sam, this has been reported in News Corporation, and Mark Latham has been responding on his ex social media account that the MP allegedly sent to former partner Natalie Matthews photos of upper house MPs in New South Wales Parliament speaking on the floor of Parliament and making comments about their looks and sexual remarks. Now, these claims come after Mr. Latham early this week denied allegations in a civil court apprehended violence order that was lodged by Ms. Matthews, his former partner, of a sustained pattern of domestic abuse that included allegedly driving a car at her and pressuring her to engage in degrading sex acts. Now, these are claims that Mr. Latham has strenuously denied. She is seeking orders preventing him from coming within 100 metres of her. That's according to The Australian. Now, today, we've also had some reports in the Sydney Morning Herald about a claim that there was a video of him and his partner involved in sexual activity in his parliamentary office. Now, Mr. Latham has denied that is the case. He responded saying, "You're asking me to dispute something I haven't seen put to me or to you." And he has suggested that no suggestion of law has been broken because, of course, it would be a breach of standing orders, the use of phones or any potential alleged sexual activity within the parliamentary offices.
So, Gavin, how have political leaders in New South Wales responded to these latest allegations today?
Well, the Premier, Chris Minns, has said that Mr. Latham should be sanctioned if those allegations are proved true, particularly when it comes to taking photos and the use of phones the way he has allegedly done in the parliamentary chamber. It would appear, he is arguing, that would have almost certainly broken standing orders, and he wants it to be investigated by the Privileges Committee.
Gavin, this is just the latest controversy involving Mark Latham. Just remind us what else has happened during his time in New South Wales politics.
Well, his New South Wales political career, of course, follows his unsuccessful bid. You know, he came very close to being the Prime Minister. He was a one-time protege of Gough Whitlam. He was even actually succeeded the former Prime Minister in his Western Sydney seat. But after leaving federal politics following his unsuccessful election bid against John Howard, he was out of political life for a bit over a decade and re-entered politics through New South Wales Parliament in 2019, this time as a One Nation MP. But that relationship with One Nation and, of course, its leader, Pauline Hanson, crumbled not too much later because in 2023, he had basically resigned from Parliament halfway through his eight-year term so that he could re-nominate in a bid to increase the party's presence in the House. And that gamble, while proving successful, within days, he had a bitter falling out with Pauline Hanson and One Nation. This was because he put out a graphic and homophobic tweet that was aimed at independent MP Alex Greenwich. And eventually he was ousted as the leader of the One Nation Party in New South Wales. So since then, he's been sitting as an independent MP. And as a result of that tweet, he was last year ordered to pay $140,000 in a defamation suit that was brought against him by Mr. Greenidge.
Thanks to reporter Gavin Coote in Sydney. A new report from the Federal Health Department has found that when it comes to managing chronic health conditions, Australia is doing pretty well compared to other developed economies. About 15 million Australians live with a chronic problem like high blood pressure, arthritis or depression. The report found many of them are happy with the care they're receiving. But public health experts say the report also identifies areas for improvement. Tanya Dindrinos reports.
Leslie Hodson is a fit and active 74-year-old.
I'm just about to plan to go to walk in the French Alps. So I guess that's active, isn't it?
She lives with high blood pressure, high cholesterol and anxiety.
All of them, the three of them, I hadn't expected to have pop up in my life. I thought of myself as fit and energetic and, you know, those factors weren't going to be really significant. And then suddenly, there they were.
Leslie was one of almost 2,400 Australian patients who completed the first of its kind patient-reported indicator survey known as PARIS in 2023. It was led by the Organisation for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, which has 38 member countries. Australia was one of 19 that took part in the survey, others including Canada, France, Switzerland and the US. Associate Professor Liz Miles is the Clinical Director for Primary Care at the Australian Commission on Safety and Quality in Healthcare, which today released analysis of Australia's results.
Out of the 10 health measures, we were in the top five countries for four of those measures. And what was really pleasing was that three of those four measures were all about the experience that patients have with their GPs. And what we're looking at there in particular, 94% rated the quality of care very highly. 94% also rated their person-centred care positively.
Among the areas needing improvement was mental health, with Australia ranking 13th out of the 19 nations.
I think that is something that we really need to take into consideration whenever we're sitting down with someone with chronic disease, working out a care plan. We need to make sure that we're also addressing not just their physical concerns, but also their mental health issues.
Only 64% of Australian respondents said they felt the healthcare system could be trusted. That is slightly better than the OECD average, but still a concern for some. Today's report suggests there's less trust among patients with lower education and income. Sarah Dennis is a professor of allied health at the University of Sydney.
The result, that sort of trust in the system, was interesting. In terms of things that we know, you know, it came as no surprise that obviously in Australia, costs are a barrier, you know, especially for people with multiple chronic conditions who might need to see a range of different providers. That starts to become a barrier to care. And obviously, once you get out into some of the more rural and remote areas, then physical access to care also is challenging.
Professor Dennis says for Australians more broadly, not only those with a chronic condition, prevention needs to be a high priority.
There's limited access to allied health unless you actually have a chronic condition or unless you're in a financial position where you can pay to access private allied health or private services through your private health insurance. You know, I'm making massive overgeneralizations here, but often, as this report showed, those with higher incomes, higher health literacy, higher education levels are doing better on that front for a range of reasons, but there's a real opportunity to see how we can support improving healthy lifestyles across the whole population.
Professor Sarah Dennis from the University of Sydney. That report from Tanya Dendrinos. Well, voting has closed today in Triple J's poll for the hottest 100 Australian songs of all time. It's a one-off poll inspired by the success of the ABC network's regular Hottest 100 vote in January, and that includes music from overseas artists. There's been an enormous response to this Australian edition, and a lot of voters have been struggling to narrow down their picks. The poll has prompted one Australian muso to call for the regular Hottest 100 to include local songs only. Alison Shaw prepared this report.
Triple J has turned 50, and to celebrate, it's asking a difficult question. What's the best Australian song of all time?
It was really hard once you start doing it. It was really hard to narrow it down.
The final votes have been cast today for the station's Hottest 100 of Australian songs. And not surprisingly, the process has forced people to make some tough decisions, agonising over which songs to choose. One musician, Ben Lee, made his voice heard.
I can't help but feel that this initiative, this Hottest 100 Australian Songs of All Time, is a little bit of a band-aid in fostering Australian music culture and supporting new Australian talent.
While the vote that's just finished is for the best Australian songs ever, Triple J's annual Hottest 100, which comes out every January, is open to songs from around the globe. Last year's countdown saw American artist Chappell Roan take out the top spot. Now Ben Lee has a controversial opinion. He's calling for the annual version of the Hottest 100 to also be limited to Australian artists.
I reckon the Hottest 100 every year, it should only be eligible to vote for Australian songs. There's enough platforms out there around the world for international music. I reckon the Hottest 100 on Triple J should be only Australian music.
And it seems listeners on ABC Radio Sydney are catching on to his idea.
I think it's a great suggestion. I really do. Yeah, we just have an Australian 100.
And why not bring back Countdown focused on Aussie talent? We're talking about Aussie culture, then we need to invest in it.
Ben Lee doubled down, telling Nine newspapers in a headline-grabbing quote that the Hottest 100 should be given to Kyle and Jackie O.
Well, I think the chances of the Hottest 100 being given to Kyle and Jackie O are next to zero, very slim.
Jane Gazzo is a music journalist and broadcaster.
I don't think Ben Lee was really meaning to give them to them personally, per se. I think what he means is hand it over to commercial radio as an entity and let Triple J concentrate on an Australian Hottest 100, which I completely agree with. Australian artists have really got lost because Triple J has diversified so much.
Lachlan Makara is the head of Triple J and Double J. He says they've got no plans to mess with the format, and including international acts is a good thing.
I think if we think Australian music is the best in the world, why shouldn't it go up against the best tunes from all around the world every year?
He says Triple J does a huge amount of work to support Australian performers.
I think when it comes to local music, we love that people expect more from us than anyone else in this space. But the truth is we've been doing more than anyone else for more than 50 years. I think it's maybe time for some other players to lift their game a bit. I think it's great to see everyone having a conversation about Australian music. What it's about now is about keeping that energy going and making sure we're all doing our bit to support the next wave of artists too, so that we can do this again in another 50 years.
Dr. Ben Green is a music lecturer at RMIT University. He's not calling for the Hottest 100 to be changed, but he does support the idea of a separate countdown just for Australian artists. He defends Triple J, pointing out its quota for local music is already much higher than the industry standard. And he says the network faces the challenge of pursuing that goal while also trying to hold on to listeners.
We do know that the numbers are down when it comes to Triple J's youth listening in particular. And that's simply because of the other options that are out there, including streaming, including the internet. It's a question rather of how Triple J and our other media can keep up with these changing times, how they respond to it.
Like many, Dr. Ben Green is enthusiastic about this year's one-off Australian countdown.
It's really important to take stock and look at the big picture and say, okay, what is our heritage? What is our canon of Australian music? And, you know, what does Australian music mean?
Dr. Ben Green from RMIT University speaking to Alison Chow. And the countdown of the hottest 100 Australian songs of all time will be on Saturday, July 26 on the ABC's Triple J and Double J networks. Thanks for joining me for PM. I'm Samantha Donovan. The podcast of the full program is available on the ABC Listen app. And we'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Good night.
Hi, it's Sam Hawley here, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. After heaping so much praise on his Russian counterpart, Donald Trump's view of Vladimir Putin has, finally, soured. But is the US president's demand for a ceasefire in Ukraine really a sign that the bromance is over? Today, Russia expert Matthew Sussex from the Centre for European Studies at the ANU on how Putin's still playing Trump. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.